Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program, outsourcing Fresno City's trash service. Is it really about saving money or making money? We will have a report. The move comes as Fresno's recycling program gets national attention. We will also look at the effort to establish a new pharmacy school in the Valley and what it will mean for students and residents. Plus, is it lights out for your local movie theater? The innovative way a community group is trying to save the only cinema in Oakhurst. But first, the Fresno City Council is expected to approve a plan this week that will turn its residential trash pickup over to a private company. The move will complete the effort to outsource the city's entire solid waste division. Commercial trash pickup was privatized last year. The city's move toward privatization now has labor and community groups questioning why Fresno would outsource a program all agree is working well and paying for itself. It is a dirty job, picking up the trash of Fresno's residents. But it is also a job that has afforded 58-year-old Joe Hill a decent middle-income salary. Those at the top of the scale can make $22 an hour.
I have a good job. I make a decent wage, but I don't feel I'm overpaid. And, you know, I praise God for the job I have and how much I make, and I know there's lots of people that make a lot less, but it's not excessive.
Hill has worked in the city's solid waste division for 10 years. Now he and close to 200 of his colleagues are facing an uncertain future. The city is working to have a private company take over its residential trash pickup. The company, Mid Valley, who last year won the contract to take over trash pickup for the city's commercial clients, has promised workers like Hill a job for at least 1 year. Their salary slashed by about 24%.
Should I be grateful that I still have a job? Yes, but seeing the big disparity in pay, and I've done the numbers. I'm an intelligent man. I have a college degree, but it's going to be devastating to our family's budget, and I just really don't know how we're going to be able to make it financially.
The move to privatize the city's solid waste division has pitted employee and community groups against City Hall and the business community.
First of all, we believe in outsourcing. You know, we think that the government is there to give some basic services, the fire, police.
Al Smith, president of the Greater Fresno Chamber of Commerce, says it just makes good business sense.
That which can be done by the private sector, in our opinion, generally is more efficient, more competitive, tends to cost less.
Dee Barnes, president of the Fresno City Employees Association, says if you follow that model, then the city's reasoning for handing off its trash to a private company doesn't fit. And here are the reasons why. The solid waste division is what is called an enterprise department,
which means the rates that they charge completely cover all of the costs of providing the service to the citizens,
including equipment, personnel, money needed to run the department, everything. So there is no cost to the city. When it comes to being more efficient, Barnes says solid waste is a well-run department.
In fact, National Geographic just featured a story about our recycling program. So we've won all kinds of awards. The service provided to the citizens is excellent. We have one of the lowest rates in the state.
The department has built up such a healthy reserve, approximately $16 million, that in 2011, the Utility Advisory Committee recommended the city lower trash rates. The city failed to act on that recommendation. Barnes believes officials took no action because they had plans to privatize all along.
They're looking to privatize because right now the city cannot use any of the money from the ratepayers for anything other than trash. So they can't use any of that fee, that $25, to pay for police or parks or fire. It can only be used to provide that service.
Fresno City's budget problems have been well documented. And while the city isn't facing bankruptcy, City Manager Mark Scott says Fresno has a very real cash flow problem and needs money now to close a $6 million hole in its current budget. At a recent city council meeting, Scott spelled out a bleak scenario.
So this situation, as serious as it is, as I said, threatens us in the sense that we will be in a position unable to make payroll, or we'll be in a position we won't be able to close out our books at the end of this fiscal year unless we close the gap in the way that our budget envisioned.
Turning the city's residential trash service over to a private company would provide the city with some much-needed cash and provide a new source of revenue for the general fund, money that could be used for police, fire, and parks. Marina Magdaleno, a representative with the union representing trash haulers, says that's the real reason behind the city's effort to privatize solid waste.
Now they are going to franchise solid waste to a private company. They're going to charge the private company a franchise fee that then they are going to in turn put that money into the general fund where they can do whatever they want with it.
Patrick Weimiller, Director of Utilities for Fresno, says while being able to generate a new revenue stream was an important factor in the city's effort to privatize, it was not the only consideration.
You have to have a decision that's also based on, can you still provide service that's as good as what you've been getting, and can you do it at or below the current cost? Now, if you can do all of that and you can still meet your recycling goals, and you have the added benefit of providing additional income to the general fund, then that would be a great outcome.
Mid Valley, the company seeking to take over the city's residential trash service, has not only promised to reduce rates by at least 15%, it has worked out a deal with Fresno that will give the city a $1.5 million one-time signing bonus and approximately $2.5 million annually in franchise fees. And last June, when the City Council approved this year's budget, it counted on receiving $1 million from this planned privatization to help balance the budget.
It doesn't recover the whole budgetary gap, but it does help narrow that gap quite a bit.
The fact that the deal with Mid Valley will not generate enough money to close the current budget gap of about $6 million has Fresno Councilman Blong Zhang questioning the effort to privatize now.
To me, it doesn't solve our the root of our problem. It takes away a service that we do well.
Zhang calls it a short-term fix for a long-term problem, and because it involves budget issues, should be part of budget discussions.
It hasn't been justified to me why we have to privatize at this point and why this process is going so quickly. You have two new incoming council members that's going to be dealing with this. Privatization is not an emergency. Now, we may believe that our financial difficulty is an emergency. I just want to make it clear. We've been having these type of budget discussions for the last six budgets in the last 3-4 years here.
Weimiller disagrees and says turning over trash pickup to a private company will produce long-term gains.
I don't see this as a short-term solution. Certainly, the franchise agreement that's being proposed here is for a nearly 9-year period of time, and in my book, at least, I don't look at that as a short-term solution.
Weimiller says the deal could generate $50 million in franchise fees over 10 years. And if Mid-Valley raises its rates, as some predict the company will do, that could mean even more money for the city. Fresno will also have access to the $16 million solid waste has in its reserves. Weimiller explains what will happen to those funds.
We own a landfill. The landfill's closed. It's an EPA cleanup site. And we continue to have expenses for maintaining the landfill, the cleanup of the gases and the groundwater that are related to that landfill site.
The cost of maintaining the cleanup of the landfill is set at about $1 million a year. But there are some who believe the money should go back to ratepayers.
You could either use it to help buy down rates even more for the ratepayers, or you could do refunds.
Exactly how the money will be used is yet to be seen. Despite those questions and opposition to the city's deal with Mid Valley, the Fresno City Council is set to finalize the plan at this week's City Council meeting.
It's not an easy thing to do to make a decision to, you know, let go of operations like this or to separate your colleagues.
Weimiller says it's part of the economic realities that Fresno and other cities are facing. Over the last few years, Fresno has reduced its workforce by close to 1,000 people. While city officials call it a budgetary decision, employee groups see it another way.
They don't believe that the city should be an employer, and that's their motto. And so this is a way to downsize and get rid of it.
Whether that's been the intent, privatizing government services is seen as a way to save money, and in the case of the city of Fresno, a way to generate new revenue. Employees like Joe Hill end up being the casualties.
You get to a point in your life, too, where what you've done has been devalued to such a large extent, and whether it's prideful or not, I would like to think that, you know, what I've done and the quality of work that I've offered the city is worth something. And to have it devalued and basically we're told that you're really not worth that much and you're only a garbage man, that hurts.
The fight over outsourcing Fresno City Solid Waste Division may not end with this week's City Council meeting. Labor and community groups say they will launch a petition drive to put the question of privatizing Fresno's trash pickup to voters. Now, the move to outsource Fresno's garbage pickup comes just as the city is getting national attention for its recycling program. National Geographic magazine says for a city its size, Fresno is one of the nation's leaders in recycling. Joining us to talk about this finding is National Geographic reporter Dan Stone. Stone is traveling throughout California in search of new ideas and innovative thinkers when it comes to the environment. Dan Stone, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Juanita.
Well, first of all, why did you choose Fresno? What brought you here?
We were doing a tour of the entire state, looking at innovations, companies doing great things, people, and cities. And Fresno caught our attention for its extremely high landfill diversion rate. About 73% of all waste produced in Fresno is diverted from a landfill, so it's recycled. That's a pretty high and very impressive number, considering other cities its size and even bigger, which divert somewhere around 50%.
Now, what is Fresno doing? What did you find as far as what is Fresno doing that's different from other cities?
Well, in Fresno, what I found was it's a culture. It's a cultural difference where kids very young in age are taught in schools exactly what kind of materials can be reused, can be recycled. And the city's devoted considerable resources to making sure that the different waste in different ways can be picked up most effectively. When I visited the city, I went to a couple different waste management facilities to see exactly how they convert things like plastics, all sorts of plastics, and aluminum, and certainly paper. And then I went to a green waste facility to see how all organic waste can be put back into the ground. And in a farming community, a farming town, and in a farming region like where Fresno is, that goes a long way.
And you talked about education and the importance of that. Is that because when you say they teach it in the schools, the kids can then go back and kind of talk to their parents about this?
Exactly. And one of the interesting points that I pulled out was, you know, it's one thing to try to convince adults that they should be changing their behaviors. They should be putting, you know, this cup in this bin rather than that one. But when they go into schools, when city officials go into schools and teach these kids, then they found that's a more effective way to influence their parents, because the kids essentially have the effect of going home and persuading, if not shaming, their parents into being more responsible with their waste.
And I can tell you they're very good at that. Well, what can other cities learn from what we're doing here in Fresno?
I think it's, like I said, a cultural difference. You have to confront it not from just a recycling standpoint, but from a waste management standpoint. From a, how does what we throw away affect us in the long run? How does it affect the water we drink and the land that we farm on and the food that essentially comes from it? If you link all of those ideas together, it's not just which bin should I throw this in. It's, you know, how are we influencing the planet and our region around us?
And I think also in your article, you talked, as you mentioned, you did talk to some of our recycling centers here, and they talked about the fact of what they put back in the ground with this being an ag community really matters.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they see it as a full closed loop. They take the waste, and it not only provides sustenance for their business and life, lifeblood for their family, but it also allows them to put that waste back into Fresno, and essentially it sprouts up again next spring, so to speak.
Well, tell us about your West Coast trip. It really sounds great. What did you hope to find, and what are some of the highlights so far?
Well, I'm just at the tail end of it here. I'm in Big Sur, headed down to Los Angeles, down the coast. I've been traveling for...
It's a hard job, Dan, that if you're in Big Sur.
This is actually my first radio interview from a payphone, I will tell you, because on the road, that's how you have to do it. But I've been traveling up from San Diego and Los Angeles all the way up toward Redding and down the coast, visiting companies, energy companies looking at algae, pesticide companies trying to innovate the way that our food is grown and could impact our health. I went to a gold mine up in Shasta County near Redding, California, near the Oregon border, to think about sustainable gold mining, if that's an industry in the state. I looked at some car companies around the Bay Area, looking at the transportation that we might all be using in the future. And then, you know, I did a report on the tiny house movement and people who are trying to innovate their homes to be smaller and more efficient, about 100 to 200 square feet, if you can believe it.
Well, you know, often, and you're probably aware of this, those of us here in California, a lot sometimes is said about the environmentalist and the laws that have been passed. But what you're saying is what you're seeing is really some great things being done here.
Absolutely. I mean, California is really a hotbed for a lot of this innovation. And the first time we did a trip like this, we wanted to go to a state where it was overflowing with good ideas, good people and good thinkers about the future of the planet. So be it energy, transportation, agriculture, water management, we wanted to see some of those ideas at work and think about how many of those innovative ideas, many of which are very young at the moment, could impact all of us and the planet in the future.
Now, your trip sounds fascinating. Where can people read your blog?
I've got a blog at nationalgeographic.com/change reaction. And people can also follow me on Twitter at Nat Geo Dan.
Now, you said you're toward the tail end of your adventure, or you're just beginning?
No, I'm at the very end here. I've been on the road for a couple weeks. I'm headed down today to San Luis Obispo, then to Santa Barbara tomorrow, and then Los Angeles. Then I'll head back to D.C. and debrief from a lot of my findings.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that. Thank you, Dan Stone, for joining us on the phone from somewhere in Big Sur. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Juanita.
Okay, Dan Stone, writer with National Geographic Magazine. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. The need for more health professionals in the Central Valley has been well documented. Now a partnership involving business leaders and educators are doing something about it, and they plan to open a privately funded College of Pharmacy in Fresno. Joining us to discuss this new pharmacy college is Dr. David Hawkins, who was the founding dean of California Health Sciences University. Dr. Hawkins was also the founding dean at California North State University College of Pharmacy in Sacramento and has more than 35 years' experience in the field. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Hawkins.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we've heard a lot about the need for more healthcare professionals. When we look at the area of pharmacy, what is the need here?
Well, there is a shortage of pharmacists in Central California. Now, there is not a shortage in Southern California, and they would be the first to tell you that. There are other shortages across the country. There is an anticipated increase in the shortage that will occur as more baby boomers get into complex medical regimens and as the Affordable Care Act is fully implemented.
And the shortage here in the Central Valley, is part of that because of the fact that there is no training institution here, no college?
We think so, and there's a need to try to recruit students from the Central Valley to be educated and trained in pharmacy, and then they're more likely to stay in this region of California.
Now, where is the nearest pharmacy school right now?
The nearest one to us is probably the University of Pacific in Stockton. There's also the University of California at San Francisco.
Okay. To have a pharmacy school here, what will that mean for students who want to go into this field?
Well, pharmacy is a very popular field. While I was at California North State, for example, we had close to 1,800 applicants for 100 seats. So having another pharmacy school, especially in this part of California, is going to increase the likelihood that very good students will get into pharmacy, be educated and trained, and go out and practice.
Now, what went into the choosing of the location for the college here in Clovis?
It's the business leaders here in town that decided to give something back to the Valley, give something back to Central California. They wanted to see healthcare improved in this region of the state. They wanted to see more jobs being created. And so Fresno, as you know, is the fifth largest city in California. This is a logical location for the Health Sciences University and the College of Pharmacy.
And what I find is interesting is how this all came up, about the fact that there is this partnership of business leaders and educators. In a way, I think, you know, what you might have is that they recognize what this would mean for the area and to invest in that. So they're investing in the Valley.
That's correct. And you mentioned the educators, too, who are collaborating with us. For example, Dr. John Welty, the president of Fresno State, sees this as a great opportunity for his students to do postgraduate work. So we're here in Fresno. We hope to attract students from Fresno State, Fresno Pacific, and other colleges and universities, of course, in Central California.
Well, as you mentioned, it is a popular program. It's one of those, you know, in-demand careers, and the fact that young people here would have the opportunity to be educated here, many would see as a great thing.
Yes.
Now, you are hoping to start classes in the fall of 2014, correct?
That is correct.
So you're putting together your faculty right now?
We are recruiting what we call the administrative team at this point. We'll bring faculty on 1 year in advance. We bring them on first-year faculty a year before they start teaching, second year, third year, et cetera. So, yes, we're already in the process of bringing people on board. And because we are a healthcare professional school, we have to go through our professional accreditation body. Also, because it's a freestanding university, we have to be accredited by the Western Association of Schools and Colleges, the WASC group. So we're very busy.
How many students will you be able to serve when you initially when you open?
We hope to be able to enroll 80 students a year for the first 4 years until we're fully accredited, and then we'll make a decision as to whether to increase that enrollment over time.
And for the students you talk about for the pharmacy program, will they have to go someplace else for a higher degree?
Yes. Our students will have to have a baccalaureate degree before they get into our program. That's not true for all colleges of pharmacy. But I'm of the old school. I think that if you're getting a doctorate degree, you should have a baccalaureate degree before you begin your doctorate training.
Now, this is going to be – so this is higher education.
Yes.
For pharmacy students.
Right.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Now, this is going to be a for-profit school.
Mm-hmm.
Can something like this make money, and where does the funding come from in the beginning to sort of get you off the ground, so to speak?
Well, there are people who will be making contributions to the college to get us up off the ground. It takes a lot of money to start a pharmacy school.
Oh, yeah.
Very much so. The idea is not so much to make a profit for individuals, but the idea is that it'll take 4 or 5 years, I think, before we're out of the red into the black. and then to take the excess revenue, the revenue over expenses, and turn it back into the university so we can start additional health professional schools and we can provide scholarships to students.
So with this being an upper-level education program for a pharmacist, I assume just like any graduate or a doctoral program, that there is, it's going to be a little bit more expensive than going to regular school.
It is. It really is. The average tuition in California, I think, is around $42,000 a year. And that's including all 8 schools of pharmacy in California. Some of them are UC schools. Some of them are private, like University of Southern California. And Touro, and also University of Pacific.
Now, you mentioned initially when you start, are there plans to expand somewhere down the road?
There is. You know, I think that currently we're looking at allied health and particularly the physician assistance program. And the idea there is, again, to address the need in this part of California. There's a tremendous shortage of primary care clinicians.
Oh, yeah.
And so we need first of all, we need to train pharmacy students how to provide primary care. And I noticed that one of your speakers coming up next is Senator Hernandez, who is introducing legislation to give pharmacists more responsibility in primary care. And I am all for that. So we plan to train our students. What makes us different, really, than other colleges of pharmacy is the fact that we are going to be training our students to provide primary care in collaboration with physicians and other healthcare professionals.
Oftentimes, anyway, when you do, for many people who have a pharmacist that they go to all the time, that pharmacist does get to know them and know about their medication, sometimes explaining it a little bit better than their own doctor.
And taking the time to make sure they're having a good response to their medication, that they're achieving the outcomes that are desired, like controlling their blood pressure, controlling their diabetes, and also to prevent any adverse events from occurring, drug interactions and drug-induced diseases. So the pharmacists following the patients closely, the pharmacists are well-trained in drug therapy management, better trained than any other healthcare professional. So we want them to use that knowledge and those skills to help achieve better outcomes in patients throughout California.
And as you did mention, with the fact that we do have an aging population,
yes.
A lot of us are getting older, which sometimes means more medication.
Yes.
So there is a real need there. What could this whole thing mean for this area?
Well, I think, there's this obvious shortage of primary care clinicians in Central California. Several weeks ago in the Fresno Bee, they had an article that talked about when the Health Care Act is fully implemented, there will be an additional 900,000 individuals who will have access to health care from Modesto to Bakersfield. And that's just in Central California. Now, you can multiply that 3 or 4 times and you get an idea about what the shortage is going to be, what the increased access of care will be for California. So somebody has to step up to the plate, and I'm an advocate of pharmacy stepping up to that plate and helping meet the demand for increased primary care for all the individuals who will now have, fortunately, access to health care.
And as you mentioned, there are other benefits for our region, economic benefits,
yes.
As well as we train people who will be able to live here and have higher paying jobs, and it really gives students a great opportunity.
It does.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Dan Hawkins, founding dean of the College of Pharmacy at California Health Sciences University. Thank you for taking your time to come in this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. I think a lot of people are looking forward to this. Sounds
great.
Exciting.
Thanks.
Well, as Dr. Hawkins did mention, it is there is not just a shortage of pharmacists in the Central Valley, but doctors as well. California lawmaker says more needs to be done to meet the demand for more health professionals that will be needed as we expand health care under the Affordable Health Care Act. Joining us now is State Senator Ed Hernandez, Democrat from Los Angeles, who is introducing legislation. Thank you so much, Senator Hernandez, for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, I understand you are also a physician in Los Angeles. So here in the San Joaquin Valley, we have a big problem with the shortage of physicians. Is this a problem in your area as well or other places throughout the state?
It's throughout the entire state of California, and as you know, with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act in 2014, we're going to be mandating every Californian and everybody in this country to purchase health insurance. We're also going to be increasing the Medicaid eligibility to 133% of poverty, and so therefore we're going to have quite a few more Californians are going to be having insurance. However, the problem is we're going to have fewer and fewer healthcare providers, we're going to have a huge capacity issue, and we're going to have a workforce shortage. And in two areas in particular, the rural communities and the inner city, which are the predominant communities of color that have the greatest need and the greatest access problems.
Oh, we already have, you know, as we've mentioned, it's well documented here, our shortage of health professionals. Now, I understand you're working on new legislation that would allow some healthcare professionals like pharmacists and podiatrists to perform duties that basically in the past they have been reserved for physicians. Now, how will this help the shortage and how will this whole process work?
Well, since I was elected to the legislature 6 years ago, 4 years in the Assembly, and then this last 2 years in the Senate, I've held a series of workforce committee hearings to address and to look at the problem. And there is obviously going to be a great need of primary care physicians. Right now, we're barely meeting that demand, and it's estimated that about 25% of those physicians are over the age of 65. And very soon, 25% of that workforce is going to be gone. So if you compound that with the baby boomers that are coming along, as well as the Affordable Care Act, we're going to have a huge demand very soon, and that's like 2014. So in order to do that, we have to do a multi-pronged approach in the state of California. Obviously, encourage more individuals going to math and science. Encourage more individuals going to medical school. Build more medical schools. We also have to look at residency programs in the areas where the greatest need is to make sure that those individuals stay there. we also have to increase the reimbursement rates for Medi-Cal for physicians and all providers. But saying that, it's not going to happen overnight. Along the same lines, we also have to concurrently make sure that we utilize the current workforce that we have under the Department of we have in the state of California, to utilize them to their fullest extent. So examples would be like pharmacists, like physician assistants, as well as nurse practitioners. Podiatrists are already independent practitioners, so they have the ability to already see. Optometrists are independent practitioners. Dentists are. So we have to look at utilizing the entire workforce we have, but increasing the abilities for those that don't have, for example, like nurse practitioners to have direct access. We need to utilize pharmacists a lot more than we have in the past.
What types of procedures are you looking at that would be included in the legislation when you say we have to sort of expand already what pharmacists and podiatrists, what kind of duties they can perform?
Well, let's take pharmacy for an example. In my opinion, pharmacists are the most overtrained and underutilized professional that we have here in the country. To become a pharmacist, now you have to have 4 years of an undergraduate degree in some type of science, get accepted to pharmacy school, you're going to be doing 4 years of postgraduate work, and then there's usually a residency program, and during that period, there's usually direct patient interaction. So a pharmacist is now graduating with a doctorate degree. There are over 40,000 licensed pharmacists in the state of California that are more widely distributed than most professions. That can be an immediate impact as far as our workforce. I don't advocate having a pharmacist open a shingle, you know, being a direct individual that's going to be seeing patients. I think they need to be work in collaboration with physicians so that they can be the entry level with for example, like diabetes, high blood pressure. And I'm not saying, let's say an individual comes in and sees a pharmacist for a first time. The pharmacist determines that that individual has diabetes. I'm not advocating that that pharmacist becomes an internal medicine specialist. But that pharmacist can now be part of the medical home. They can be part of the medical team to work in collaboration with a physician to make sure that there's absolute patient safety. And now the patient can see the pharmacist, and then when at the appropriate time can be referred to the specialist or the internist to collaborate with that individual so we can utilize them more efficiently. I'll give you an example. In the Central Valley, I'm sure there's many communities that very seldom get internists that go into those communities, but you have pharmacists that are available to work, say, with telemedicine, to collaborate, to use standards of protocol with those physicians.
You know, some might question, as you said, sure, there is the need, but, you know, what about the quality of care? Will these new health professionals, will they be trained in new areas beyond their normal field?
Yes, they are, and that's exactly what they're doing right now. But there's several things that absolutely need to be done before we allow anyone to do this type of work. Obviously, there needs to be a national standard, which that the profession needs to demonstrate. There needs to be a national board or a national testing, which they do. They also have to be licensed under a independent board within the state of California so that ultimately the state can protect the consumer in the event that someone is not appropriately, just like the medical board would as well. So there has to be complete oversight. And, of course, the training, you know, they have the residency programs. This is a workforce that can very easily and be incorporated into the medical model and work collaboratively with physicians under standards of protocol.
You know, there's often been some tension in healthcare ranks between different groups, sometimes like the nurses and the doctors.
Mm-hmm.
How can you craft a bill that would implement this sort of change and get all of these major groups to sort of buy into this?
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I mean, they are very difficult and they're very contentious bills. Anytime you do a scope of practice issue, there is always going to be opposition. And the question is always public safety. The question is always going to be training. But I would not move legislation forward unless I am convinced that that particular profession meets all those requirements and that the public safety is utmost paramount. And then the question that I would pose to the opposition is, okay, you tell me, you know, it is proven, it is safe. Now you tell me, if that's not the case, how are we going to address this shortage? You know, how are we going to see these patients in the rural communities and in the inner city? We need to have that care for those individuals.
You know, how have we gotten to the point in California where in some regions we have such a high demand? I know it's been a ongoing problem in the Central Valley, this health professional shortage.
Mm-hmm.
Why has it been like this for so long? Is it just not enough educational facilities, not enough instructors? What are some of the things we face when it comes to that?
Well, I think where the problem lies is, unfortunately, in economics. When you look at, say, physicians when they graduate from medical school and they start to pick their various residency programs, unfortunately, fewer and fewer of them are picking primary care and family medicine. And the reason why is because, unfortunately, the reimbursement rate is less than, say, specialty care. And more of them are going into the specialty care where you can get a higher reimbursement rate. Now, the physicians that do graduate, let's say the primary care and the family physicians have a tendency to migrate towards the larger cities. But even within the larger city, let's take Los Angeles, for example, they have a tendency to go to the communities, the higher income communities. Therefore, there's less access in the inner city where there's the poorer communities, and obviously less access in the rural communities. So we not only are going to have a capacity and a workforce shortage issue, but we also have a distribution problem, and we need to solve that distribution problem by having incentives for individuals to go into primary care, incentives for them to go into inner city, and incentives for them to go into the rural communities to see these patients.
Now, when do you plan to introduce your legislation?
You know, we are currently talking to several provider groups, trying to formulate different thoughts as far as what their capacity is, what they're educated at. So, you know, if we introduce it, it'll all be in the form of what's called a spot bill in January. It'll most likely be a two-year process to go through, you know, the various committees to make sure that, you know, all the public safety is dealt with, to deal with the educational levels. So it'll be a fairly long process. So we are meeting with, you know, all the various health professions at this time.
Okay. Well, something like this is usually a long process, but thank you, State Senator Ed Hernandez, for discussing your legislation with us. It seems to be important legislation that will truly impact the Valley.
Thank you.
Thank you for being
here.
Bye-bye. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
The subject of trash has dominated Fresno headlines in recent months. In addition to the controversy over the privatization of residential solid waste service in the city of Fresno, a recent online post by National Geographic cites Fresno as a nationwide leader in recycling. But what if Fresno's current recycling rate of 73% were 100%? On this week's edition of the commentary series The Moral Is, Fresno State Biology Professor Madhu Kati says we should look to Sweden as an example.
Can you imagine ever running out of garbage? Probably not. Maybe it has something to do with the second law of thermodynamics, the one about how the amount of disorder in a system will always increase. Or maybe it is this time of year, between Black Friday and Christmas, when we are constantly exhorted to go out and buy things. Things we may or may not need, but things we are told we should want, because they are bright and shiny and cool, or because this is how we are supposed to help businesses stay in the black and help the economy. Accompanying all this jolly holiday consumption, of course, is a growing mound of garbage from all the packaging and the gift wrapping and the unwanted and rejected gifts that end up, eventually, in our landfills. It is hard to imagine us running out of garbage. Well, as it happens, the country of Sweden is running low on garbage lately. So much so that they import it from neighboring Norway and get paid for taking it off Norway's hands. So efficient have the Swedes become at recycling and composting all of their household waste that only 4% of it ends up in landfills. As a result, they simply aren't producing enough trash anymore. Wait, not enough trash? Not enough for what? For generating energy, of course. According to a recent NPR story, Sweden runs one of the most successful waste-to-energy programs in the world, generating one-fifth of the nation's heating and powering a quarter million homes. But now, because its citizens have become so conscientious about minding their own household waste, Sweden has to turn to other countries for garbage. Isn't that a nicer problem to have than the litany of more depressing environmental challenges we face these days? Why don't we all do this? Kill two birds with one stone, reduce the amount of waste going into landfills, and reduce our need for fossil fuels in the process. Indeed, Fresno County is now entertaining a proposal for a new garbage-fueled power plant. And Fresno is already recognized as a national leader for its recycling programs. It also has the distinction of being the birthplace of the modern landfill. The pioneering design of the Fresno Municipal Sanitary Landfill, a national historic landmark, set the standard for municipal waste management in 20th century America. Now Fresno can lead us again in the 21st century by turning our trash into energy. In nature, there was never such a thing as garbage until humans came along, because any waste produced by one species is consumed by another in the circle of life. Our industrial civilization, paradoxically efficient and wasteful, broke the circle, and this may be the first time that a single species has generated too much waste for ecosystems to handle. We must close the circle again, and soon, before our planet is dead and covered in giant trash heaps. A planet running short of garbage? Why, that's how ours was not too long ago, and how it can be again if we put our ingenuity to solving the problems we have created. For The Moral Is, this is Madhusudan Katti.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Could it be lights out at some movie theaters in the Valley? The closing of the only cinema in Oakhurst has prompted community groups to come up with an innovative way to generate money to save their cinema. Joining me is Matt Sconce, Matt Sconce with Save the Met. He's one of the group of people working to save that cinema. And also John Moses with Fresno Filmworks. Matt.
Yeah.
Why is the only cinema in Oakhurst closing? What's behind that? What are some of the reasons?
Well, I think one of the main reasons was the economy went down and people nationwide stopped seeing movies as much. And when you're in a small town, small mountain community, and people stop going to the theater and they have high overhead costs, there's just no way to maintain the doors staying open. So we decided we needed to change the model of how the theater makes its money if we were to keep the doors open with consistency.
I'm sure you mentioned to me that you grew up in Oakhurst. How did you feel when you heard the Met was going to close? What does that mean to you? What does that theater or movie theater mean to you? I'm sure it has a lot of memories.
It definitely does. I mean, my first date was at that theater. All three of us grew up at that theater. Since I was five, I was watching movies there. And I think I share the same sentiments as the entire community, which when it shut, we were in shock. And then there was actually a grieving process that occurred because it was so central to all of our ideas of what the mountain community was.
Why is, when you look at this, a cinema like that so important for an area, for a community?
Yeah, it's so important because of the word you just used, community. I think little by little people are separating from each other. And when you're already separated by land up there and there's not a lot of closeness, if you lose areas where the community can come together, I think that impacts the community negatively. And I also believe that it helps shape the youth up there to have a place to go to be together and a safe place to go.
Now, you mentioned this effort that you and two other people have started. Tell me about what you're trying to do. And have you kind of put everything you have into this as far as, you know, what else you're working on, your jobs, projects?
Yep. Keith Walker and James Nelson are the other two. And the three of us have basically put our lives on hold for this month. We have till the 31st to try to get enough members to sign up at the Met to actually make it viable. And we're showing the landlords that the community still wants their theater. So we need 3,000 individuals to do this, and we're putting everything we have into it. And our wives are very understanding, and we have been moving at a very rapid pace.
So tell us about this effort. How does it work? What are you trying to do?
Okay, well, what we need people to do is go to SaveTheMet.com or go into the theater from 9 to 6 every day and sign up. They become members, and they pay kind of like a gym membership. They pay a low monthly fee at the start of the month, and then they watch every single movie that comes to the theater for no money. And so what that allows them to do is it creates consistency for the theater and it gives them the ability to see more movies. So it's a win-win. And for my wife and I mean, just paying the monthly fee, which is $19.95 for an individual or $34.95 for a couple, just that monthly fee is less than if we came down to Edwards one time because down here. You know, Expedition and our family. And so it just makes sense for the mountain community to have their own place that's affordable and can keep it open with the consistency.
So this is the funding model sort of sounds like something that you have with Netflix.
Yes, it's a Netflix gym membership type model. And basically some people will use it a lot. Other people use it a little bit. It all balances out and it keeps the doors open and lets us upgrade to digital, which we're going to have to do because the studios are stopping sending film soon.
Now, how many people do you really need to take part in this to kind of to keep the cinema open?
We need 3,000 people at a minimum to do this. We're halfway there, and it's only 11 days into the month, so we're doing pretty well. We basically need people to tell people because it's a rural community, the entire mountain community. It takes word of mouth. It takes telling your neighbor, your friend to go to SaveTheMet.com or go into the theater to sign up because if people wait, it won't happen.
Now, you talked about is this something that you think – this model will be sustainable? Because, you know, a lot of times people will start something off and it'll be
right.
Big and then they'll fall off. But what they have to do is really to keep this up, to keep the cinema viable.
That's correct. We have to keep growing the membership because it's going to be cyclical. Some memberships will drop off. Others will come on. We're also expanding into the local businesses, the hotel industry, the tourism industry up there. They're actually buying memberships for the tourists that come up there. So when people buy a hotel room, they also have movies the entire time they're up there for no extra cost. Tenaya Lodge is on board with that, and a lot of other people are coming on board. And those will be stable pillars in this model.
So basically what you're saying is the community needs to step up and say, you know, this is important to us, and we're willing to support this.
That's right. The community has basically till the 31st to do that. And if they don't do that, then we'll probably lose our theater for good up there.
Well, you mentioned one thing. You said that you're still showing 35 millimeter.
Yeah.
later film. So when you mentioned how you're going to have to go to digital, I want to bring in Mr. Moses, John Moses, here with Fresno Filmworks. How has the digital transition affected small theater owners and operators?
Well, nationwide, it's affected them quite a bit. More than two-thirds of the screens in the country have already gone digital. And by, you know, as Matt said, very shortly, the major studios won't be supplying 35-millimeter format anymore. For art cinemas like Fresno Filmworks operating out of the Tower Theater, it's less of an immediate problem, although long-range it will be one, but we're still showing films in 35-millimeter. Most of our screenings that we have the monthly series and an annual festival in April. Last year, of our monthly films, 11 of them were 35 millimeter. So the small distributors are still maintaining a commitment to what's now called the analog format. 35 millimeter has been relegated.
They're hanging on, right?
They're hanging on. But that's bound to change, especially, for example, Sony Classics is an important distributor of independent films and foreign films, but they're connected to Sony, mm-hmm. and they're all wrapped into the digital conversion, which they see as going to be 100%, you know, relatively soon.
No, what does this change mean? I mean, as far as you have to get new projectors, hardware, and I'm sure there's a cost with that.
You know, incredible cost. Prices that I've seen range from $50,000 to $100,000, yep. Conversion cost per screen.
Yep.
What was that again?
$50,000, you know, is the cheap version. $100,000, probably, or you know, somewhere in between those two extremes, the real costs. But the studios have been funding or facilitating some of those conversion costs through a virtual print fee that they pay to the manufacturers of the 4K digital projectors that are being installed. But some concerns are that the 4K projectors are going to be replaced in about 5 years with laser projectors.
Yeah, it's always changing.
So it's always changing.
It's always changing.
When it comes to technology and innovation, it is always changing. You know, just like our cell phones, you get one and you get comfortable with it, and then they come out with a new model and you've got to go pay hundreds of dollars more for it. So it has to do with that ever-changing technology that you talk about. Well, you mentioned again the switchover comes when? Complete switchover?
Well, complete switchover probably by the end of 2013.
Yeah, I would say. Some are going earlier, mm-hmm. some are later. It's just slow rollout, except 20th Century Fox is going the first. And then
so that means for both you have that you've mentioned, both of the theaters, will you be trying to upgrade to digital? And, you know, have you have any kind of effort going to kind of get that the money that you need to do that?
Well, we can screen digitally. We have in the Tower Theater one of the first generation of digital projectors, the 1.3K projectors, which were used 5-6 years ago before the upgrades that are more recent for the conversions in the local multiplexes, but. We show Blu-ray occasionally through that projector, but the digital cinema packages, they're going to be more connected to the mainstream releases,
yeah.
the blockbuster releases.
We have it built into our model. So if this membership model takes off, if the community basically comes on board and does this, then we will start the upgrade process.
Okay. But when it comes to Fresno Filmworks, because of the kind of movies that you show, you're saying you might have more leeway, more time because, you know, the small independent
filmmakers.
Do.
Although, as I'm also a film historian at Fresno City College, teach film studies there. And what I'm concerned about is how this digital conversion is going to affect the archives that exist out there, that some of the classics are not going to be available in 35 millimeter, won't be preserved on 35 millimeter, won't be able to go to the art houses, repertory theaters anymore, that they aren't just, they just aren't being preserved in the way they are. So, for example, this Sunday we're showing Meet Me in St. Louis, which is in the vaults of Warner Brothers Studios now. And there is no print to circulate.
Wow.
It has to be shown on a Blu-ray. That's the best that we can do.
You would think, especially with some of these old classics, they would want to save that.
Well, they want to save them. I mean, there may be one or two prints in their archive, but they're not circulating anymore because it's such a valuable product now. It's an artifact. It is to be preserved and not circulated.
Well, is it because the new digital projection system, is it that it just generates a better picture, or is it just this is the new technology and the way people are going?
There's a couple things about it. One thing is that you don't get scratched film. You don't get all the problems that you have with film. Sometimes, you know, at the $3 theater, like if you go there, you'll notice the film has already been used somewhere. And so when they play actually film, you'll see all the scratches and artifacts. And digital is always...
Oh, but that's what makes it so neat.
That's what some people love. It gives it that feel, you know, it gives it that warmth. And what digital does is it gives it that perfection every single time. So there's a trade-off.
Okay. Well, some people appreciate the old-fashioned way, but you're right. In other terms, it's just they want that quality picture that you can see with digital, the same as when you have a digital, you know, camera. Mm-hmm. With the moves that are taking place right now, what are your concerns and how could that change what Fresno Filmwork does?
Well, we may have to rely more and more upon digital. And, you know, I don't want to knock digital entirely because some films couldn't be preserved at all if we didn't have digital restorations. So again, Meet Me in St. Louis, the digital Blu-ray is probably richer Technicolor than the prints that exist now. But that kind of conversion over to digital will probably be a slow process. We'll see how long we're still able to acquire licenses for the 35 millimeters that we are showing. We've got one Friday night foreign language film coming from Sony Classics, Chicken with Plums, that is going to bring out all the lovers of French film, and it'll look glorious in 35 millimeter color.
Well, what you're talking about really is for people who love movies, who love theater, who love film, especially the old ones, and those who love foreign films. They really have to kind of let that be known, and they have to support it. You know, it's easy, like you said, to do it the easy way, but there's something about still going to a movie theater that's just a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
So, Matt, before we go, what do people need to do to kind of support your effort?
They need to do two things. They need to go to SaveTheMet.com, like right now, tell people to go there, and they can look at all the information there. All the frequently asked questions are there. Our short video describing what we're doing is there, and they just need to they need to make a decision. If they want to keep the theater up there, they need to become a member and tell people to do that. And if they don't, that's okay. We want the community to decide, and then we'll know. And they can go into the Met also from 9 to 6 and do that. They just need to tell people and spread the word at SaveTheMet.com.
And you, John, you have a movie, you said, this
yes,
weekend.
Two movies, Friday night, Chicken with Plums, Sunday afternoon, Meet Me in St. Louis. Check out all times and cost of tickets at FresnoFilmWorks.org. We've got quite a nice website for people.
Okay. Matt Sconce with Save the Met and John Moses with Fresno Filmworks. Thank you both for joining us today. We appreciate it. Love the discussion.
Thank you.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.